Trigger warning. The following episode may contain content that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. A girl is kidnapped from her job at a coffee stand. The police begin to look for clues to identify her kidnapper. A couple weeks pass before a ransom note and a photo is posted on a local park's community board. Tracking the kidnapper across the country, he is finally apprehended and the police are ready to put the case to rest. But little did they know, they had just caught one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history and had only just scratched the surface of the crimes committed by this monster. This is the story of Israel Keyes. Israel Keyes was born in Richmond, Virginia to Heidi and John Keyes. He was the second out of 10 children. He was born into a Mormon family and was homeschooled and taught Mormon beliefs for a few years before his family decided to leave the faith. When he was 5 years old, his family packed everyone up and moved to a remote plot of land. They were isolated from society. No water, no electricity, and all lived in a one-room cabin. Not one bedroom, one room. His family began to attend a church called the Ark, a white supremacist Christian church. And as the children grew, they began to be forced to sleep outside, no longer able to cram all 10 growing children into one room in the cabin. To survive, the kids had to hunt their own food, chop wood, garden, and even work at a local farm just to be able to make some money to help support their family. When Israel got older, he began to show an unhealthy interest in hunting and took it beyond killing for food. He just wanted to kill anything. Anything with a heartbeat. Growing up, he had plenty of friends, but they began to slowly pull away from him the more they saw his sadistic behavior come out. Israel started to break into homes, light fires in the forest, and was killing cats brutally. He had tied a cat to a tree at one time and shot it in the stomach in front of his friends. He laughed as the cat spun in circles, writhing in pain. When he turned around, expecting to see his friends laughing along with him, he saw one of his friends horrified, while the other vomited from the gory scene. At another time, he told his friends about when he had skinned a deer while it was still alive. He was enthralled in his story and was surprised every time by the responses of others to his killing. He did not understand why they didn't enjoy them like him. This was when his friends started to notice something was off. It was way past a rebellious teen stage and into something darker. His lack of social structure outside of the odd Amish-like community he lived in made it hard for him to understand why his friends were turning away and not enjoying the same things as him. He started to pick up the cues and realized he just wasn't like everyone else. And he decided the only way to continue without consequence was to hide this side of himself from the world. As he aged and his mother's extremist behavior increased, the children were no longer allowed to listen to music, learn musical instruments, watch TV or movies, or enjoy anything of the outside world. The intense, strict rules of his household drew a wedge between him and his family. When Israel was in his late teens, he started to reject the Christian ideology. He told his parents he was an atheist, and they became enraged, kicking him out of the house. His parents told all of his siblings that they were never allowed to talk to him ever again. So he went into the world he's never known, all alone. He started to develop an obsessive interest in Satanism, almost like a fuck you to his parents. In 1997, when he was 19 years old, he violently raped a young girl who was tubing down the Deschutes River in Oregon. He stalked her from the tree line, and when he had the opportunity, he abducted her at knife point and raped her before he had planned to kill her. He told police that the reason why he didn't kill her was because she was a smart girl, and she started talking to him, saying that he was handsome and she didn't understand why he felt the need to rape her because she would have dated him. He decided to let her go and said if she ever told anybody that he would find a way to kill her. He regretted it for years and was always very paranoid about one of his victims being alive out there, knowing what his face looked like. But she kept her word. She never told anybody. And even to this day, she still hasn't come forward. In 1998, when he was 20 years old, he enlisted in the army. He began to drink heavily, like a bottle of Wild Turkey every night, kind of heavy. He says that he never killed anyone during his time in the military, but says he did rape a couple of women, some college students, while he was in Egypt. In 2001, he ended up getting a DUI and was honorably discharged from service. This is when killing became a true hobby for him. He decided the best way to do this, the best way to not get caught, was to choose people at random, always in a different location, always in a random location, never killing in the same place twice. He was a meticulous planner and would plan his killing vacations for months before committing the crime. Yes, I said killing vacations. He would fly to a random location and he would choose somebody at random to kill. It could have been anybody just passing by in the grocery store. He would watch them, learn their behavior, and then hide what he would call a kill kit nearby. He would then fly home and prepare for his vacation. He would then fly back to this random location and follow through with his plan. He would never have to travel with his weapons because he would get everything where he was and hide it to come back to it later. Israel had about 12 kill kits across the United States at one point. 12 kill vacations lined up, ready for him when he got the itch. That means that 12 people lived that he had planned to kill. It could have been you. Israel had talked about how he would often abduct people or have them submit to his will by using the force of a gun, but never actually killed people with a gun unless it was needed. He said he enjoyed strangling them because he could watch them go unconscious, truly holding their life in his hands. In 2000, Israel began dating a woman who he gets pregnant while living in Washington. His daughter was born in 2001. He told police during interviews that since his daughter was born, he could never hurt a child. So does this mean that he had targeted children before? Are some of the missing children that we know about maybe victims of Israel Keyes? In 2011, Bill and Lorraine Currier in Essex, Vermont, get startled awake from their bed by Israel pointing a gun at them. He ties them up, puts them in their own car, and then drives them to an abandoned farmhouse. He spends the night brutally raping Lorraine while Bill was in the next room listening to it all. He then strangled Lorraine before shooting Bill. After his kill vacation with Bill and Lorraine, he started to have issues with his ex. She was constantly drunk, and Israel saw her as a bad parent to their daughter. Ironic, since he's a serial killer. So Israel takes his daughter, and they move to Alaska. He began dating a nurse practitioner, and the two decided to move in together. This is when he made a fatal mistake. It was difficult for him to be able to take these kill vacations as his daughter grew when he lived with his girlfriend. I think he felt trapped and it made him sloppy. He targeted a victim, 18-year-old Samantha Koenig. She lived in his town. He broke one of his rules. There was minimal planning, no kill kit. Samantha worked at a coffee stand and was closing up shop in 2012. A last customer approached the window and ordered a coffee. She begins to make the drink, and when she turns to hand it to him, she's startled by a gun in her face. He demands her to turn off the lights in the little building and give him the money from the cash register. She thinks it's just a robbery, so she obeys. He climbs through the window, takes the money, and then tells her to start walking, jamming the gun into her side. He leads her out of the coffee stand, into the parking lot, and loads her into a white Toyota pickup truck, and they drive off. Her boyfriend was supposed to pick her up that night from work, but when he arrived, the lights were off and no one was around. He knew this was odd, this was out of character. She would have called, she would have told him. He goes straight to her house and waits to hear from her with her father. As they wait, the boyfriend gets a text message from Samantha's phone. It says, "I'm going to stay with some friends for a while. Tell my dad." Immediately, they knew something was wrong. Her father reports her missing to the police, and they start to look into it. they discover the security footage that was inside the coffee stand, and it caught the whole incident on tape. Police realize they have a kidnapping on their hands. Israel drives Samantha back to his own home, where he puts her in the shed in his driveway. He binds her and gags her, and then heads inside the house. Later, he comes back with a bottle of wild turkey and begins to drink it all. He turns the music up in his shed and proceeds to rape Samantha through the night. The next day, he and his family get ready and they head out on a family cruise vacation. This truly shows the coldness of the man, to be able to rape a young girl all night long and then be able to wake up the next day and go on vacation with his girlfriend and daughter. 2 weeks after Samantha's abduction, her boyfriend gets another text message. It says, "Connor Park sign, under pic of Albert, ain't she purty?" P-U-R-T-Y. Purty. Makes you cringe, huh? Police go to the location, and under a picture of a labradoodle named Albert is a Ziploc bag. Inside was a ransom note demanding $30,000, and there was a picture with Samantha holding a copy of a recent newspaper showing that she was still alive. Police are glad there's evidence of her survival, so they pay the ransom and they wait for Israel to begin the withdrawals. They put a tracker on the debit card that was attached to the money, and they track his movements from Alaska all the way to Texas. Police finally catch him in Texas, but when they do, no Samantha. Police take Israel into custody and begin to question him. "Where is Samantha? Is she dead? She was alive a few days ago. You showed us the picture. Where is she now?" He is not cooperative with police at first. But a little while later, Israel requests to see police again. He is ready to talk. He tells them he will tell them all, but they have to do him some favors first. Wary of the demands that he could make, the police ask him, "All right, well, what is it?" He says he wants a cigar, and then he laughs. And the police finally see the cold side of Israel Keyes. He gets serious again and says, "Really, I want a cigar, an Americano, and a peanut butter Snickers, and I'll tell you anything you want." The police give him what he wants, but before he starts talking, he makes one more demand. He says, "I don't want the media to know my name." He says he will tell them everything as long as nobody finds out his identity. The police agree. He didn't want his daughter to find out that it was him. He said the reason why he wanted his identity kept a secret was so that his actions didn't haunt his daughter her whole life. The police agree his name will not be released. So Israel begins to give information, slowly, trying to hold on to the last bit of control that he had. He's the only one in the whole world who knows what happened to Samantha. And he knows it. The police had no idea of the monster that they had just captured. They expected to only hear about Samantha, not realizing that they had a serial killer sitting right in front of them. He begins to tell the story that sent chills down their spine. He fills the police in about the kidnapping and the rape, and then to their horror, about the murder of Samantha Koenig. He explains how he had strangled her the day after he kidnapped her before he went on his 2-week cruise. The police are immediately confused because of the ransom note. It had a picture of Samantha alive with the most recent newspaper. They were not prepared for what Israel was about to tell them. It had been cold enough in Alaska that leaving Samantha's body in a box in the shed had frozen her solid by the time he returned from his trip, so no decomposition had occurred. He told police that he thawed her body out, put makeup on her, brushed and braided her hair before sewing her eyes open with fishing line. The photo he had sent with the ransom was of her dead body. He then says that he dismembered her and threw her body parts into the Matanuska Lake. The police end up finding her remains and were able to bring her home to her dad. Thinking that they had finally closed and were ready to get Israel behind bars, they are shocked when he begins to keep talking. He then recounts Bill and Lorraine to police. Police ask him, well, where are the bodies? He tells them he put their bodies into trash bags and then put them in the basement of the old farmhouse that he committed the crime in. When police arrive at the location, they are shocked to discover that the building is gone, completely demolished. They look through the rubble, but no bags. They end up having cadaver dogs go in, and they alert police right where the basement would have been, which confirms that the bodies were there. The only thing that could have happened was that during the cleanup from the demolished site, the bags got taken to a landfill. Crews and crews of police search the landfills, but ultimately come up short, never recovering Bill and Lorraine's body. Police realize now that they have a serial killer in their hands, and they're not sure how many bodies they're going to have to unearth. But this is when things go wrong. Someone leaked Israel's name to the media. When Israel finds out, he goes cold. He stops talking. Shortly after, he commits suicide in his cell, leaving behind a cryptic message. He drew 11 skulls with crosses on their heads and a pentagram and his own blood on the walls of his cell. We still have no idea how many people he really killed or assaulted. He was the only one who knew, and the only one who will ever know. Thank you for listening. If you have not done so already, please leave us a review. This really helps our podcast grow and reach more listeners. I will be reading them out at the beginning of episodes to show my love and appreciation for all of you.